We're ready.
All right.
All right.
We're back in the audience.
We have no audience, but we have a great panel here.
On the internet, they're listening on the internet.
Yeah.
Everyone has to leave the mic where it is, despite what it feels.
All right, we got. These are all, I guess, ex-enforcement people, except Alan Rosenblatt. He was left over from the other panel, and he's here now to join us. What we have here is we got Ted Levine and.
Let me suggest. Why don't we start by people making any comments that they would like to make in light of the first panel's discussion, where they either agree or disagree or have some
of the ideas
that they'd like to make. And let's start with Wally Timoney.
And Wally, why don't you introduce yourself so the audience will know who they're talking about. Wally Timoney was a former deputy director of the Division of Enforcement. Alan Rosenblatt was with the Division of Investment Management. Ted Sonde was in every division in the commission, too many to name. Dave Doherty was also the associate director of enforcement. Ben Greenspoon was the head of the trial unit and, associate director. And Ted Levine was an associate director of enforcement during the relevant period. And, of course, Herb was the first director. But go ahead, Wally. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows who's here.
What I wanted to do by way of providing a bridge between this panel and the first panel was to go back to a point that was being made about the formation of the enforcement division. There was a lot of discussion on the first panel about Chairman Carey wanting to have an enforcement program in the Division of Trading and Markets or the Division of Trading and Exchanges. And that was all very true. But the Division of Enforcement was founded, if you will, by Chairman Casey. And Chairman Casey's goal in creating the Division of Enforcement was, from my perspective, to remove Irv Pollack from the regulatory function in the Division of Trading and Markets. History is a matter of perspective, but I was a young kid down in the Division of Investment Management working on a project that Jack Dudley had assigned. He sent us out to do an examination of a fund complex. He was really interested in turnover, the amount of portfolio turnover in the fund. And he sent a guy named Dan Schatz and yours truly out there to look into turnover. As we were looking into turnover, we stumbled onto something called a give-up, basically. It was a matter of the fund assigning its brokerage to a certain broker-dealer, who in turn was split apart of that brokerage with another broker-dealer, and the second broker-dealer would sort of take instructions from the fund manager as to where to send the money. All of this demonstrating that fixed rates were a farce, that there was a lot of slush in the commission structure, and various money managers a lot that were taking advantage of it. Well, we came back with this information about how we had discovered these give-ups going around a whole string of firms and ending up in a firm called Dishy Easton in New York. He brought that up to Irv and made a point about how the give-ups were working. He took that, and I think it was very much the formation for what he did in the fixed rate hearings. And he really worked hard on that and toppled the whole fixed rate structure, in essence. And as part of that effort, when he was undertaking that effort, I think it was Chairman Casey's view that there was too much of an enforcement flavor in this regulatory process, and that someone else other than Irv Pollack ought to be setting the regulatory tone with respect to these very important market issues. And that's how, from my perspective, the Enforcement Division was formed. It was formed not to create a wonderful, effective enforcement unit. Rather, it was a law of unintended consequences in the sense that the Irv is pulled out of regulatory stuff, put in charge of enforcement in the hope that he'd no longer be involved much in the regulatory side. In fact, he was, in any event, but even more so, I think, because of the cases that we brought and the way we used the cases to set regulatory policy.
But Wally, I'm not quarreling with what may have been an objective, but I do think historically what happened was that there was the Wells Commission that was set up to look at enforcement, and I think that was a recommendation that came out of the Wells Committee, including the Wells. What?
Wells came out of the National Student Marketing case because they were offended that we had sued them without giving them notice.
Yeah, I know, but I think one of the recommendations out of it was to set up the enforcement division, as it was also to give Wells submissions.
No, my perception is the same as Wally's, and frankly,
what do you think, Irwin?
Well, I can tell you what Casey said.
Yeah.
And it's in the report that Dan Hope put together. On his last few days of leaving the commission, I had a conversation with him, and we had an excellent relationship, the two of us, which respected each other, and he was very candid. And he said, you know, I worried that when I left the commission, you would undo the regulatory policies that I thought ought to exist. And I said to him, well, I understand that, Bill, but you're not going to be able to stop it. And he then said to me, I now think you're right, but there's no way I can undo the program that we set in place. So that there's no question that he felt that he wanted some other person in the regulatory side because he felt strongly on the...
No, but all I was saying was I think the division, the concept of the division came out of the Wells Committee.
May have. But the,
so anybody else remember?
There's always a number of reasons why people will do
what
things.
What was it, Ted?
You're right. It was one of the recommendations of the committee.
Yeah.
But that's okay because the committee...
Who was on the committee? It was Demler, Wells...
Demler and Manny Cohen, but the committee was at the behest of the chairman, so what did you expect?
Well, I think...
Well, let's move on, though, because I think that's pretty much something that most we can do in that area.
But, Irv, with respect, I have a slightly different perspective in transition maybe into the later years, and I was at the commission from in 69 to 83, which would cover this entire period. And two things that struck me as I thought about this program. One is, and I mentioned this at lunch, there was three distinct periods. I would call the golden years, which I would say was like 70 to 77. Then a transitional period, which was really Harold Williams' chairmanship. And then there was what I call return to deregulation when John Shadd came in. And two things that I think were really important in that context. One, in the golden years, up to when Powell became a Supreme Court, we had an incredible favorable Supreme Court relative to the SEC. Both the Second Circuit, you know, Timbers was a former general counsel. It was a very well-received agency. You got whatever you wanted. It was the most expansive view of the security laws. And that made life easier. And you contrast the capital gains where injunction was a mild prophylactic to Aaron when it was a drastic remedy. And it would reflect the attitudinal change which impacted the enforcement program. Second of all, in the period you just talked about, the enforcement program was not well known on Main Street. It was an unknown program of a small agency. But once the foreign payment program set in and it put it on the face of the map, it changed the attitude of everyone about enforcement. It became more difficult because it became more intrusive program than it had been, which was essentially a regulatory program. And lastly, and people can disagree with this, it was a simple program with no remedies except for the use of creative relief in the early 70s. And once we started overlaying both a more punitive program, which happened when Shadd came in, and more drastic remedies, the courts became a lot less receptive to the agency's mission as one of protecting the public. It became much more difficult. So we had all these debates about preponderance of evidence against clear and convincing. All the debates of whether you get an injunction or not, we flip to administrative remedies. And what I noticed in looking at this, no implied right of action, the courts changed their view of us in a manner which I think hurt the program or made it more challenging and more creative. And so I think the program, and I'll finish on this thing, a remedial program, which was the one that Irv talked about in the earlier panel and Stanley, where you try to accomplish and move industry standards, was a lot easier in both the courts and the public eye to sell than a more punitive program, which, by the way, I think the public perceives the current enforcement program as. And I think that happens to be today something that people like, but I think it's a more difficult program to run in the long run if it's perceived to be punitive rather than remedial.
In line with what you people are talking about, the word that Irv and I came up with, we almost had a bipolar concept here. There were highs and lows. Is that, David, is that your view of it? Wally, David, is that your, do you remember the highs and the lows?
I remember the highs. I don't remember any really significant lows. I think that in any aggressive enforcement program where you're out there on the cutting edge, you're going to get knocked down every now and then and not have a good reception with the courts. But I think overall the program really had a good rising impact to it.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Wal? Do you remember the highs and the lows?
I'm hard pressed to think of lows.
I have one here when they turned off the spigot on going after lawyers. I don't know if you remember. Was that you were here then?
And I also recall. I mean, we had what I would call budget difficulties. Toward the end there, late 70s, there was really an effort to cut back on the budget and so forth. And there was a period when it wasn't a low, it was sort of funny when I think back on it, when in the early, it was 1970 or so, when Judge Budge was the chairman, and he decreed that we would not take transcripts of testimony, and that we would go out with a yellow pad and interview the witnesses. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, we wouldn't even go from the home office. We should call somebody in the regional office who would do the interview, but make sure that person used a yellow pad and not a transcript.
And there were some restrictions on making long-distance telephone calls.
I don't think that stopped us. I mean, as a matter of fact, we worked around it. I thought we took that with a sense of humor.
But don't you remember we had a quota system that for every major firm we hit, for every minor firm, we had to bring a case against a major firm?
Well, no, that was a big...
You don't remember that, huh? You remember that, Irv? Yeah, you guys remember that. That's telling tales out of school, but go ahead.
No, that was a big, if I can call it, transition, because when the enforcement programs were in the various divisions, they did bring cases, but they weren't really tackling the giants in any one industry. Right. And we put when the enforcement program was all put together in one division, I think the hallmark of the enforcement program at that point was that we would tackle anything. And that's when we brought the case, we brought the Lockheeds, the Exxons, the Northrop. So every case was a big case.
Right.
And there was no hesitation to bring it. We'd sit with Stanley at the commission for days on end arguing about the cases. And Stanley had this, I would call it an iron behind, because he would sit in that chair for hours and hours and hours and argue with the commission as to why we should bring the case. But there was never any hesitation to tackle the big cases.
And that was
different from...
Yeah, and I think that one of the big differences is the home office enforcement program kicked into gear was that we, in effect, had the equivalent of a reserve squad. Unlike the regional offices who had to handle all the matters in their region and were always stretched thin, we had the luxury of looking for problems that were arising. And what we would try to do is tackle it in a programmatic way, and instead of just reacting to each matter that came up on its own, we would see problems arising, we would try to get out ahead of it, we would throw a lot of resources onto it, and with the objective of getting at it quickly, getting ahead of it, bringing a series of enforcement actions that we would then hope would have a significant impact on the violative conduct. And oftentimes we had a proposed legislative objective as well if we made the right factual record.
Now, do you recall, folks, I'm sorry, Ted, did you want to say something?
Well, I thought Dave really hit the nail on the head, because I remember when I first came from general counsel's office to enforcement, which was in 74, and I heard you, Stanley, talk about programs.
Right.
And that was a new word to me. I mean, I understood the word, but I hadn't heard of it in the years I had been at the commission before. And all of a sudden, I began to see that someone was looking at the big picture and talking about how do we go after this area and that area. And you created a series of programs. And frankly, I was very skeptical at the beginning because I didn't quite see how that was evolving. And it was that kind of input that I think really created it. I mean, it's exactly what Dave describes, and that was the process.
Actually, I would want to. I think the difference between the enforcement program then and the more recent ones was we didn't announce programs like are done now. We we clustered a number of cases, and then the program developed. For example, insider trading. Today, or in the recent past, people announce we're now looking at corporations, or we're now looking at broker-dealers, and the whole, and I think that's a big difference as in the way that, and also the difference is the program in the 70s was multifaceted. You did not know. It wasn't geared to a program. Everyone thought that they were under investigation for everything at every time, and that made everyone more compliant.
But I always thought Chad came up with the idea of insider trading as a way to divert us
right.
from other things, and then stumbled onto the Boskys and the Mike Milkins and the others. And I always thought that that was an attempt to get away from Stanley's notion of programs.
Yeah, well, the other thing that they did, as you recall, we'll hear, because Ben was in both our division and general counsel. But did you fellows feel like I felt, and Herb, I guess you were on a commission at the time, that there was an attempt to stifle the division in the sense that, I mean, and they did it in certain ways. For example, they brought in the general counsel reviewing group, and what was that all about, Ben? Did you turn traitor when you went up to the office of general counsel?
Of course, I knew who was paying my salary. I remember that very well. The Harvey instituted a program of reviewing every matter that went to the commission, not just enforcement action, but of regulatory recommendations as well, rule proposals, and we assigned each memo to a member of the staff, and then the supervisors would all gather on Monday morning, and we would go over each matter. Now I must say that the enforcement, we occasionally had some problems with some of the enforcement matters. But in the main, the vast majority of the division enforcement's recommendations had no opposition from the general counsel's office. The only thing that sometimes bothered me was if there was having come from the division of investment management, it sometimes bothered me that if there was something egregious, but also an Investment Company Act violation, the tendency was, oh, let's not confuse people. That's too hard. It's too technical. Why don't we just drop that? And very often that was done, and probably was a good idea.
Stanley, I would like to. I did not participate in that because at the time that Harvey was the general counsel, I was working for you. But I would like to say something apropos of some of my observations briefly at the time I came to the commission. Because you hired me specifically to be in the trial unit. And the impression that I got at that time was that you were going to beef this thing up because you were going to do a lot of trial work and that you were going to go after people who might think that the commission was a toothless tiger that did a lot of talking, but when it came to having the chips on the table, they were gone. And so you were going to create this trial unit. And I'm happy to be a part of it, frankly. And I think that in terms of contributions to whatever you had, whatever the programs were, the trial unit was a necessary adjunct to it. Because without the trial unit, you would not have been able to implement many of the programs.
And I think
that's the perspective that I
have. Well, the one part that I would add to that, amend it, is that we were facing when we started to bring our programs, and as Wally said and Dave said, hit the big people, then they of course brought in the big lawyers. They brought in the Edward Bennett Williams, the Milk Goulds, and we were there trying cases with people maybe a year or two out of law school, and we were getting our clock cleaned in the courthouse, and so therefore Irv and I discussed this, and I said, we got to have a trial unit, and Irv's going to finish this, and he's going to tell you about, and I said, let me try and do it, Irv. And Irv said, you're going to have a revolution, and we did have a revolution, because he thought that that would hurt the people that were there and their spirit, and we did. We had a very tough time, but I think we overcame it and it worked out pretty well. Do you remember those days?
I always thought it was very important to remember that when Edward Bennett Williams came in, he was he had owned the Redskins at the time.
Oh, Jesus. He's got to tell these things.
Stanley would often begin the meeting and maybe take up about 98% of the meeting. By telling him who should play quarterback.
That's funny, Wally.
I remember Stanley often saying that maybe there should be an improvement at guard. I mean, Ed Williams got a lot of advice from Stanley about football.
Listen, when I had the Gulf and Western case with Ed Williams, he, by that time, owned the Orioles.
Gotcha.
And I gave him a lot of good trades, none of which he did. And, of course, they won the pennant in the World Series without my help. But those were the kind of lawyers we were running up against,
I don't think
owned baseball teams.
Yeah, I don't think this panel should be over and talking about trials without talking about Bob LaPrade.
Oh, Jesus.
He was
the trial unit.
Beginning and end of the trial unit. Stanley may have forgotten this, but I started in the Washington regional office, and then I thought I would transfer to headquarters, so Stanley said, come on over, I'm starting a trial unit, and Bob LaPrade and you. You're going to be the beginning of the trial unit. Here's this concept now, and it went on from there, but Bob was there from the beginning tried cases everywhere.
Sorry, Dave. Let me go back for a second to the review process in the general counsel's office. Again, this is a matter of perspective. But my perspective at the time was that I believe Harold Williams was the chairman. And Chairman Williams wanted to hear another voice other than the enforcement division voice on all enforcement matters. And it was at his initiative that this review process, I think, was set up in the general counsel's office. And if you take that back even another step, I think for a number of years through the 70s, whenever a chairman came in, the Senator Harrison Williams, who was over on the Senate side and is the head of our oversight committee, would extract a blood oath.
Oh, that was Proxmire.
No, Proxmire was on the... Yeah,
yes, Proxmire used to get the promise.
Senate side, right. Well, I thought...
Now, Williams wanted to see me go. No.
Harrison Williams...
You got the wrong...
No, I don't have it wrong. You didn't let me finish. Times have not changed, guys.
Yeah.
What had happened was that Williams would extract a promise from the chairman, from the candidate for chairman.
Fire me.
That he would control Stanley.
Oh, I see. That's right.
And Proxmire would extract the promise that Stanley would be given a free hand. So
I would not be fired. He wouldn't be fired.
Can I add one element to this?
That's true. That's
getting away from...
I forgot where you were going.
Stanley being hired or fired. And that is, if you looked at the relationship of enforcement and regulation in the middle 70s, up to the point when Harold Williams came in, which will tie into this review process, enforcement played an inordinate role in the formulation of regulation. And I mentioned four things. Beneficial ownership definition, tender offer regulations, going private, and perks, all of which were regulatory initiatives in the 70s, I believe, most of which took place in the middle 70s, and I see Dick Rowe in the audience. And enforcement, not only because of the cases it brought, but also it had a strong voice in the direction of the regulatory initiatives coming out of that, which were negotiated both at the commission and at the staff level. And enforcement played an exceedingly strong role. One of the things that Harold Williams wanted, and the commission wanted, was to take enforcement back out of having such a large influence in that scheme. And one of the ways of doing it, particularly when the new general counsel came in after Harvey left in 78, was to have the general counsel play that role rather than enforcement. And I think that impacted not only the review enforcement cases, but also a lesser role. And I think today probably the enforcement group plays a lot different role relative to a regulatory scheme than it did when we were there at that time.
Yeah, Chairman Pitt was always supportive. He would bring me in to try some of the cases. So I think it came after, sometime after him, which we won't finger where it went. But in any event, and it wasn't the general counsel, it was the fact that the commission was trying to rein us in, because they found that, and it wasn't Harold Williams, it actually started before him, that they got themselves so involved in these programs and in criticism, and they felt that they had no control. Let's take the payments program, for example. The payments program, we started down in the division, finding that after the during the Watergate hearings, you had companies testifying about making illegal campaign contributions. And as we usually did, I would call in, I called in Bob Ryan, and Bob, I said, Bob, go over to Gulf Oil and find out how they made that illegal campaign contribution. Of course, he came back and told me that they had the secret slush fund of $10 million and they were making all kinds of contributions. And of course, we started to bring cases. Well, the commission didn't know where we were going. And as long as they didn't, and you didn't know where we were going, but we were going, and we would.
The commission didn't want to go there.
Yeah, and they didn't want us to go there. So we went on and on and on until, you know, you talk about today's atmosphere with corruption. Well, we had corruption that was beyond belief. There were 650 companies were making these illicit contributions. And they were not only campaign contributions, but they were bribes being paid in overseas matters. And then when the people say, well, that's overseas, you know, you don't have to worry about it. We found that they were bribing milk producers here in the United States. We found all kinds of perks. You talk about perks now. But we got a little too far when someone brought a case against Playboy Hefner because he was expensing the towels of his mansion. I thought even we were going a little too far, that they had to disclose what he was doing in the confines of his bedroom and why he needed so many towels. But the point was that one day Alan Levinson and I were down in Texas, and we got a call that we had to come home right away. It was Ray Garrett was the chairman then, and Ray said, "Look, Stan and Alan, I'm glad Alan took some of the blame. Why I don't know, because he's just a good guy." But the chairman said, "You two guys," and I guess Irv was involved too. He said, "You guys go out and fix this problem. I don't want to see, you know, too many more cases." And that showed the creativity, and that's how you got the volunteer program, which seems to have been dusted off now and is now being used a little bit but not now. It can't be used now because of the atmosphere. There's no volunteers anymore.
It's called cooperation.
You get shot at now if you volunteer. But that started the volunteer program where Alan had a, you know, Alan and I sat down, and to Alan's great credit, we came up with this program, and it worked. And so we got what did we bring? We got about 650 volunteers that came in under that program.
Well, the importance of all the things you're discussing show how important it was for enforcement to really be the moving force, because despite the commission's reluctance to go for legislation, your intimate relationship with Senator Proxmire resulted in the Foreign Corrupt Payments Act.
That's right.
And so you see that, and I mentioned in the earlier panel, and you see it again today in the Sarbanes legislation. The enforcement, or the lack of enforcement, is an impetus toward getting policy moving in the proper direction. I'd like to get back to what you mentioned, though, Ted, on the pendulum swinging as it did, so that the courts did not support the agency, and you're absolutely right, in the manner that it had before. What I'm wondering about, was it because you think of the punitive actions alone, or was it just a change in the composition in the Supreme Court and in the lower courts that caused a more conservative attitude with respect to enforcement and regulation, because you had, as I look back on it, a movement toward deregulation, the same thing that happened in the late 80s and 90s, and then followed up with the scandals and corruption that we've had recently. So it may have been a combination of the both of them.
But Irving, I think it was more of a very conservative court getting in. Reading.
Well, that's why I was saying.
Douglas left and Powell joined in 75, and that from the Supreme Court level, that changed a lot. Timbers left. Timbers was a big supporter of the commission on the Second Circuit. Kaufman, the chief judge, was a big supporter. And he used to write about the commission as a special.
Well, we never got hurt too bad in the Second Circuit. Yeah.
I don't think you can overlook the fact that when I came to the commission, it was right after Kennedy had been assassinated. A number of us came in the 60s, and we were taught, I was taught, that you ought to come and help the government, that you ought to work. It was a matter of pride to make a contribution to the government. Over the period of time that Ted's talking about, the attitude towards the government, it doesn't matter whether you talk about Republicans or Democrats, civil servants were the bashing boys, that it was no longer, they were lazy, they were corrupt, there was fraud, there was this, there was that. It was never anything here like that, but in fact, that was the tone. And I think part of that started to influence the way in which the commission was received in the courts, and I think also it was a change. But I think that had a real impact on the way in which we were perceived in the government for 20 years, whether you go back to Carter, who ran against it, or Nixon. The great thing, I think, Stanley, that happened is Hamer Budge was here before Nixon took office so that he could at least in some way protect, frankly, you and Irv and some of us from the political process that I think would have...
Well, you know, one thing that we ought to talk about for a minute is, and this was raised by Dave Silver in the last... the one thing that Irv and I insisted upon was that we didn't want this to be an ad hoc, case-by-case program, and that we did want to see permanent change, which was brought about by certain things that were done. And let's look at some of these things that that we believe the enforcement program was responsible for. Talk about corporate governance, David. We're now going through a new phase of corporate governance, but don't you think that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act brought the federal government into corporate governance at an early stage?
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. Certainly in our programmatic approach, we always try not only to catch the people that are engaged in the violations, but long term we want to try to get the problem fixed. And what we saw in those cases was a lot of lack of integrity in the books and records of the firm, and that bore on the integrity of the management of the firm, and sometimes it bore on the integrity of the quality of the earnings. And so with the background we put together in the cases, we were able to get the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act passed that really did get you right into the corporate governance area. And there were mandates to maintain internal procedures and controls and the like.
Irv and Ted, takeover legislation. Is my recollection correct that it was we in the division that were instrumental in bringing that about? Because as I recall, we had tremendous opposition in the among the lawyers in the bar. Do you have any recollection on that, Ted?
Well, I think you're right, but
the 5% rule and if you make an offer, you got to treat everybody fairly.
Regulation 14D is what you're referring to. Came out of the
The Williams Act.
Yeah, the Williams Act, but that also, and also the SEC v. Becton Dickinson, the Wellman case in defining tender offer. The defining beneficial owner, which was a much more expansive definition than ever before, all came out of abuse in the enforcement program, by and large. I mean, and it was jointly with the other divisions, and that led to either legislation or regulatory reactions. So I think there was a great role, and enforcement was used as a laboratory to identify problems which the regulatory scheme was then used to fix. And that's the way I remember the system. And we used to use that, the approach. Going private is another perfect example. I mean, while Al gave that speech, I think it was in 74, nonetheless, we had all these problems with going private cases, and that led to the growing private regulatory scheme on, well, I think it was 13E3 or whatever it is, I don't remember now. So I think you had all that. But the interesting thing on governance is that the commission itself was schizophrenic.
Right.
In 1978, the commission, as I recall, proposed that you had to have internal controls discussed in your annual reports, and there were 900 letters received in opposition, and it was dropped, if you recall that. And also, there were speeches about what we give today as given. There were speeches by commissioners saying we shouldn't disclose the difference between independent and non-independent directors because it put a negative connotation on non-independent directors. So I think it wasn't a picture where we had a unanimous support at the commission for governance change. It was so we use cases, and I think the public persuasion to get it done. That's my recollection.
Herb, what is your recollection on that?
Well, I think it's right. It reaffirms what the first panel and this panel have been saying, that when you go up against the establishment and you try to change basic operations that have been going on purportedly among your reputable industry, as people will assert, it's very difficult to do that. So how do you counteract that? You counteract that by taking investigations and showing that the practices are not as honorable as they are prescribed. And I think that you can see that in its most aggressive form in the recent period that we've had. Once the disclosures and the enforcement show tremendous corruption in terms of your so-called reputable industry, even if it is only a small part of it, creates an atmosphere out there that is terribly detrimental to the confidence that people put in the marketplace. Remember, for many years, our enforcement, regulatory, and disclosure problem was considered the best in the world. People all over the world were envying it. Nobody could attack our rules on financial statements because purportedly the rest of the world did not have as good a oversight on accounting things. And just in a few years, with a few scandals that were notorious in their extent and in the corruption in the CEOs and in the auditing and in the professionals and the investment analysts and in the regulatory schemes that were there, for example, the NASD's failure to control the over-the-counter market. All of those things resulted in what never would have happened before. And now, probably legislation that has swung the pendulum the whole way. And back to something that you said, there was a reluctance to do things because everybody said you're interfering with states' rights, you're interfering with the state settling of the ethical standards or the regulatory standards for directives. And you'll see now, if you read the results of the Enron thing particularly, where the vice chancellor in Delaware writes an article, a very, very comprehensive and excellent analysis, saying do the states now have to re-examine the respect that they gave to so-called independent directors. Now, that's a revolutionary statement. And he goes through there and shows you in example after example how just saying that you rely on independent directors may have been a very, very a misapplication, because people are not that independent, as events have shown.
Yeah, Ted, let me. I want to give you a question, then you can ask it. Let me point out one of the things we did was not only did we assist the commission, but we created certain nomenclature. Greenmail, Ted. I always thought that that came about during a meeting that either Wally and you and I or Ed Herlihy had, and then we came up with the name Greenmail. Is that your recollection?
No. Yes, it is my recollection, because how can I disagree with you? But I don't remember who was there.
Yeah, that's in the dictionary. Now, why would you remember that at all? No.
Well, it did happen that way, but the one thing I want to say about Irv, in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act before, the commission drove legislation. Here, in the Sarbanes-Oxley, I don't think the commission drove that. I think Congress drove it and forced the commission now to adopt a lot.
I think that's correct.
And I think that's a big difference where the determination of legislation when we were doing this was really coming from the staff of the commission, actually, or the commission. Now it's being fostered upon the SEC more. And if you see these timetables, within 6 months they got to adopt this, 4 months this. Whether they liked it or not, I can't tell. But I didn't think they controlled the destiny of the agency, quite frankly, in that regulatory battle.
Well, Ted,
they did not.
But on Corrupt Practices Act, it was the Congress coming to us. The commission didn't want to do anything on that.
Oh, no, the staff did.
What? Oh, the staff wanted to do something. And the staff. Of course, we wrote it. It was Sandy Burton that did controls and the internal controls, and I did the books and records. But the commission was against that. They said we didn't need it, and we did need it. But let's go on a little bit.
One point before you go on, Stanley, on this corporate governance issue, there's no question that we were involved in a payments program. we were interested in corporate governance. If you remember, the key word we used over and over again was stewardship. We went to the commission on each and every case and said the issue here is the stewardship of the officers and directors for the use of the assets of the shareholders. And we came at that over and over and over again. And it was our goal to try to do something about corporate governance. Now, we had to use the tools that were available to us, which would be the disclosure mechanism, because obviously the SEC did not regulate the activities of officers and directors as would the states. So, but the direction throughout that program was corporate governance. We were definitely aimed at trying to see to it that the persons who were charged with stewardship for the assets of the company disclosed how they were using those assets. We were more focused on that than we were on the so-called corruption, if you will. The fact that the prince of someplace got a payment, or the premier of Japan was involved in something, was only part of our focus. Our key focus was how was the money being managed on behalf of the shareholders by the officers and directors. So it was definitely a corporate governance direction, and it definitely came from the Division of Enforcement. Yeah.
Let me ask you on insider trading, Ted. I see Paul Gonson is in the room. Misappropriation theory. How did that come about? Was that mostly general counsel? Was that, how did that come about, Paul? Do you remember?
Ted will remember as well too. It was that.
You want to come up and just get on the microphone here? You're gonna have trouble.
You're a guest speaker.
You have to use this over here.
Because I think that's one of the most important. That was one of the most important legal accomplishments that we've ever had in the insider trading, wasn't it, Herb? The misappropriation.
I'm just now paraphrasing Ted Levine, who's here, of course, to speak for himself. But I think it was the combination back in the late 60s and the 70s of the rise in takeovers and also the rise in options. So you were having situations where one company's going to take over another company. And by the use of options, you could leverage enormously. So put down a little bit of money, you could really make a huge bundle if you had inside information on a takeover. And the theory that was in existence then, which was officers and directors owed a duty to their own shareholders not to disadvantage them, didn't apply when you were now talking about securities not of your own company, but securities of another company, the company about to be taken over. So there developed another theory, which was a theory, first it was called, you may recall some of us use the phrase market access or market information, so it's distinguished from inside information. The Supreme Court rejected that distinction, said no, there's just one theory. But eventually the theory developed that if you were defrauding the source of the information, as distinguished from people in the market, that also is a violation. That's how the
how did that come about? Was it your creation, the general counsel, or did it? I guess what you're saying, it came out of one of our cases that we developed, but you had to go and defend it in the Court of Appeals, and we had to come up with. Does anybody know where the first wording of the misappropriation theory
came? Well, it came out of Chiarella. After the Supreme Court decision of Chiarella, the program was a great loss, and we did two things. We adopted 14E3, a rule to deal with tender offers, insider trading tender offers, and we started developing, looking for an alternative theory. The exact case, I don't remember, but there were a series of cases in that time period where we had to come up with alternative theories. Yeah. You were gone.
Oh, no, misappropriation was, that was during my time.
Was it?
Of course, we lost, as most people here know, we lost the Chiarella case,
right. Yeah.
Although the Chief Justice pointed out that it was because we had raised it too late. Huh. And he said that if we had brought that up earlier, then it might succeed.
I have a little umbrage at the word we.
The
SEC brought a civil action against Mr. Chiarella,
right.
And he settled that action, and he paid over some $30,000 in trading profits. There was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York who read about the settlement in the newspaper, and without advising, I believe, I don't think Stanley knew about this until it was up in the Court of Appeals, without advising the SEC, went ahead and he indicted Mr. Chiarella for the action that the SEC had settled. And he was convicted, and the Second Circuit affirmed the conviction. And then it went up to the Supreme Court. So the theory on which the case had been presented by the assistant U.S. attorney to the jury was a theory which wasn't a misappropriation theory. It was sort of the classical theory, but it didn't fit. And because it didn't fit, the Supreme Court said that Mr. Chiarella owed no duty to the people in the market. He was a stranger to them. He wasn't a fiduciary of theirs. He wasn't an officer and director of the companies he was trading in. And then the government said, well, what about this other theory, the misappropriation theory? And the Supreme Court said that in criminal law, as distinguished from civil law, you can only affirm a criminal conviction based on the theory presented to the jury. Otherwise, it'd be sort of like a directed verdict, which you can't have in criminal law. Okay. If this had been a civil case, then the Supreme Court could have considered that alternative theory, because the rule on appeals in civil cases is you can affirm on any basis, even the basis not relied on by the district court. So the peculiarity that this was a criminal case meant the court couldn't reach it. But there were, in four opinions of the justices, some indication that this might be an acceptable theory in the next case. And then it was really the enforcement division then was starting
Thanks,
to push
Paul.
Those next cases.
And unfortunately, even though we didn't, the commission did not, was not the moving force behind the criminal case, the commission ended up, I think Ralph Farrar argued the case, or at least on behalf of the commission, and pressed the misappropriation theory at that point.
Well, let's talk about another rule. Rule 15C211. Does anybody have any idea what happened there?
Who knows what it is, Richard?
You don't know 15C211?
Well, I can tell you what it is.
Yeah. Herb, you remember that? What happened there?
Attempt to try and put the responsibility in the over-the-counter market for people examining the financials of a company before they started trading in it, so that there would be some control. And it arose again because we had brought an enforcement case.
Right.
And the desire was not to have to bring enforcement cases, that they were trading all this stuff that didn't amount to anything and was just trading numbers, to put some responsibility on them. So that was the start back then.
Well, the problem that we encountered is that people went into the market and started making markets in these cases, and they weren't responsible. There was no way of breaking
right.
the cycle.
Right.
And I think we used the suspension, actually, and the 15C211 as a device to get at these two problems, which put a burden on the market maker and also to break the cycle.
What happened was that market makers were trading what they call by the numbers. They didn't want to know what the company was about. They had no idea. We found stocks starting at a few pennies a share, going up to $100 a share. And when you ask the market maker, didn't know that the place had no business, had nothing they were doing, was a complete shell. And so we put in the concept of know your security. In other words, one of the great concepts in the securities area is the know your rules. You got to know your customer, and you got to know your security, and many other things like that. And that was the concept, and it's still again one of the really important rules. And these all came about as a result of enforcement work. Not only did we bring the case, but we worked with the regulatory divisions in developing the remedy. Let's talk about strategies. One of the things that the public doesn't see is they do not see that when this division was taking action, that there was some thought that went into those actions that they were taking. And
for good reason.
Well, the access theory. It's now got a new name called Gatekeeper. David, what do you know about access theory?
Well, the access theory is really one that's designed to give you the most bang for your enforcement buck. The theory is that when people want to get to the market, they can't get to the market without going through certain access points or securing the necessary advice of other professionals. So if an issuer who has got an improper agenda wants to get to the public market, he needs professionals. He needs financial services, or he needs a broker-dealer or an underwriter. He needs a lawyer, and he needs an accountant. And so
the theory is that since these people are either the gatekeepers or the points of access to the market, these are the places that we would look at very carefully and hold this category of professional to a very high level of accountability for their conduct, and by that way control the flow into the marketplace.
And in other words, there was a program designed to go after the entities that were responsible for the people getting access to the marketplace, and that they could control their people. And as a result of that, Irv, that's what you developed in connection with the whole compliance system, where every broker dealer has to have a compliance program.
Yes, yeah, correct.
Stanley, it didn't develop the way you just described it, though. No. It developed because you used to ask the question, why did this happen? And really, the way access theory developed was when you asked the question, why did it happen, you look beyond simply the entity, let's say it's a corporation, and you started saying, well, how could this possibly happen? I remember the conversation. Where were the accountants?
That came a little later.
That was a little later, though. Stanley did this on purpose, really.
Well, I don't know which agency he was at. Was this the SEC or some other agency?
I think, Ted, it came out in part because Stanley was asking, as Irv was, how did this happen in a place like Merrill Lynch or in First Boston? Where was the compliance program? Where was the supervisors? Where was the system in place that would have and should have prevented this? And in effect saying, and I think that's where the legislation came out, that basically said you have to have, and if you want credit, you have to have, in fact, a compliance program for the brokerage industry, at least, that said it's in place. And once you had that in place, you, in effect, had a defense to an enforcement action. I don't think it's ever been successfully utilized, but it was that basically put the compliance program in place.
Actually, Irv, I think it was, we didn't have the manpower to police everybody, is my recollection.
So we had to
conscript the private sector, and we wanted to, in effect, transfer the obligation from the commission to the private sector. We couldn't bring every case, but in the cases we brought, we made sure that those firms would take steps to prevent it from happening again, and that's why you have the whole compliance system. Is that right?
Right.
Well, you don't want to say anything else?
Well, but Stanley, we use the same concept, really, in a lot of cases, including a lot of the foreign payments cases, where we would do enough investigation to have a basic case, but know that we had not done the full investigation that was required. So we would then bring a quick enforcement action, and as a part of the resolution, we would require that the defendant, issuer, public company, appoint a special counsel who would be required to undertake, in effect, continue the investigation internally with a certain degree of independence so that he or she could do their job, and then they would prepare a report and submit it to the commission. So that was another example of putting responsibility off onto the subject of investigation and freeing up our resources to do other things.
The basic theory of the securities laws going all the way back was the commission was supposed to be in the background with the cannon or shotgun, as Justice Douglas said, and that the industry was supposed to, through self-regulation and self-discipline in the firms, or compliance, as we used to call it, make the system work properly. Today, the growth in the industry is exponentially greater than it was during our time. And this commission, with all the resources it has, is not going to be able to go out and put a supervisor or a policeman in every institution or every business out there that contributes to the marketplace or operates in the marketplace. And so the programs have to be designed to impose on the people who are out there having the direct access to the markets or the direct access to investors to have programs in place that protect the investors and society from mispractices. And therefore, you're now getting an increasing regulatory imposition on what companies have to do. For example, take just the certification process that now is in place under the Sarbanes Act. If you read that, it's not just the certification of the documents, it's a whole litany of things that have to be done in order to give a basis for the CEO or the chief financial officer to put his name on a certification that the financials are correct, regardless of GAAP, that they fairly present the success of the company in terms of its finances and also in its operations and in its disclosures. So the whole emphasis is, again, let's get the disclosures out there. As Justice Brandeis said, it's the greatest thing you can have in any field, is sunlight on what's going on. And you see it in some of the disclosures that are coming out in the present context. For example, look at the impact that the disclosure on the pension given to one of the leading members of the management community, which showed how low these things were getting in terms of the greed that was involved there. Those things, just in disclosure, did more than any enforcement case you could bring. And I think that our background shows that enforcement is important in sort of being the backstop and getting people's attention that they must obey these things, and it's in their self-interest to do it. Otherwise, there will be serious consequences that will have personal consequences as well as economic.
What would you say, Wally, that you would advise a broker-dealer client about knowing? I mean, let me go two steps. If you were now at the commission, how would you take this compliance concept that we started to the next step? How should the current commission be using that concept? Do you think they've exhausted the use of it by now?
No, not at all. But let me go back to that my understanding of what we're talking about in terms of access theory and so forth. I saw the access theory as a tactic that was employed within a strategy. Now, the strategy, for example, we had an interest in municipal bond cases. Dave and I had right. I remember one time I'd come to Urban Stanley and I said, you know, I read something in the Wall Street Journal about these municipal securities dealers in the South who are all called bond daddies, and they're selling these defunct or these bankrupt issues, bond issues, and charging whopping markups. And I said, well, you know, it'd be something interesting to look at. So I said, yeah, go look at it. So I went down and I visited a couple of these places and I came back and I said, you know, these shops are really boiler rooms. You know, I'm sure you guys had seen them, but I had never seen them. I had read about what boiler rooms were like, but I'd never seen them. I said, these shops are boiler rooms. We should do something about it. So they said, go to it. So Dave and I went to work on that, and we brought, I would say, maybe 10 cases against companies, and we enjoined 50 individuals or whatnot. And our strategy was to bring enough cases to demonstrate that there was a need for regulation in the municipal securities area. Now, as part of that strategy, we brought the cases and then brought that to the attention of the Hill and Market Reg and worked out this legislative program. But within the strategy, there was a tactic. We also wanted to stamp out the problem and as we were going along. And the tactic was to use the access theory. We first went after the dealers who were charging the excessive markups, because they provided access. Then we moved over to the underwriters. And then finally we moved over to the lawyers. And that's where the screaming really started, because we were trying to bring the lawyers in and have them responsible for the disclosure and the offering statements and for the opinions that they were rendering that these bond deals were real deals as opposed to shams. So I saw the access theory, if you will, where you put pressure on professionals as a tactic. The overall strategy was to get legislation to regulate the area. But within that strategy, we had the access theory, and we put the pressure on the various access points.
I'll give you just a little color and background on that. When we went down to, we actually litigated some of these cases, and we went down to file our action in Memphis, in federal court in Memphis, against these bond daddies. And as was customary, I stopped into the U.S. Attorney's office as a courtesy to let him read the complaint before I filed it. And the complaint really was a classic boiler room, outrageous, just classic, with markups over contemporaneous cost on these bonds in the vicinity of 25, 50, and 100%. And he read the complaint and he said to me, well, I don't think you got much of a case. He says, you know, I don't see that there's much difference here between the used car salesman. You know, you sell your product for what you can get. So you're not going to have much luck in there. And fortunately, the judge saw it differently. We tried the case and won. But we did end up going to Congress because at that point, dealers who dealt exclusively in municipal bonds were exempt from registration as broker-dealers with the SEC. And we'd never dealt with municipal bond people before. And so we ended up getting legislation. That exemption was removed, and the problem went away.
Now, one thing, Arab, that our problem was that we didn't have all the nice toys that the current enforcement group has. We couldn't go and get bans on officers, directors. We had trouble, you know, getting fines or getting money back. Ted, did that stop us? What did we do about it? Did we just say, yeah, we can't do it, so we'll go home?
I got a case right here where we did it in 1975.
Tell me about the case, David.
It was SEC versus Technicolor, Inc.
Yeah, what happened?
Or Techniculture, Inc. And we remember that one, Ted? And this was just a shell promoter that was doing it over and over again, and we went out and we got an injunction against him, and the judge enjoined him from assuming a position as or continuing as an officer director of any public company unless he said so.
Well, it helped. It helped.
Dan, what do you think of that?
In the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah. But Stanley, the use of to me the greatest tool in the modern enforcement arsenal was the consent. Without which the program would either back when we were there or today could not function as a practical matter. And the consent gave you the ability and actually ancillary relief as part of that, or to develop different ways of getting remedies that you could not specifically look to a statute to get. And if you settled 80% of your cases at all times, or 90%, which we did, you were able to meld the theories of what we wanted to do and put it into practice in the consent. Because once you had the violation and you're trying to be remedial, the consent gave you that, whether it's back in Vesco or Parvin Dorman or Westgate, or it just gave you the, and it was only the creative mind that could come up with the relief, whether it was disgorgement or things like that. So to me, the greatest thing we had was the consent, and still is today.
Well, that's, of course, what made the remaining 10% of the cases that we had to try so awful.
You only tried the bad cases.
Well, of course we had to try the bad cases.
I think what we did,
our one loss record was sort of like the Orioles today, I guess.
What we did was we used the power of the courts to extend the statutory grants of power. First cases we did, we said the court can appoint a receiver. SUC may not have that authority, but the court could do it. The next step was, once you had a good case in there, the court could order restitution. And we emphasized that once the SEC was in there and got a decree, it wasn't the SEC's decree anymore, it was the court's decree. And so you, Your Honor, can use these things to get these scoundrels and to stop them or to give the money back.
And disgorgement the same way.
Disgorgement the same way. And so that approach was
used. Inherent powers of the court.
It gets back to what you said much earlier in this program, though. We had a reception in the courts that I think in the late 80s and certainly in the 90s, reversed itself. And the courts did not understand or at least appreciate the program's policy and the policy of the statute to protect the public. And so they looked at this more like it was some negligence case out there where two parties were performing. So I think you got to get that culture out into the people who really control the industries so that the leaders of the industry will be establishing that culture with their people below them.
Yeah, now, so we were able to accomplish many of the things that the commission today is able to accomplish, although they're doing it with specific authority. We did it through the consent decree. Is that your point, Ted?
Yeah, except for two things, which I actually think hurt the program.
What's that?
One is civil penalty. Because you can get disgorgement, but we didn't have a civil penalty that
way.
And two, I think the C&D is can be used, can be helpful, but cannot be. In other words, I think it goes.
We used that too, didn't we? Weren't there C&Ds?
No.
Oh, sure we did.
No, we used 15C4.
But we brought out C&Ds. I'm telling you, by consent.
We didn't have the statute.
By consent.
Oh no, even with consent,
we did it with. Yes, we did. We did it with consent.
Yeah, I learned never to disagree with the boss.
I'm telling you, we did it.
I tell you, that's one thing we never did. Art Matthews recommended.
I'll have to.
Art Matthews,
did we do it?
What you would say is.
Well, I'll
like
have
the
to.
Person in the audience, Dan Falk, said, was that they would include something like that in a decree, but didn't say.
I remember we used the word that they would cease and desist, but I'll have to go and.
But you know, not all of the progress that we made in terms of ancillary relief was through consent. Now, for example, there was a case that we brought years ago where we litigated a very important corporate governance issue. That was Canadian Javelin. You remember Canadian Javelin was a Canadian company, and we said that their filings with the SEC were improper, inadequate, and so forth. And we actually litigated in the Southern District of New York a provision where we requested the court to appoint a special review person and a person who would specially prepare the filings of the company, require the board of Canadian Javelin to instruct this special review person to have to do this work and to have this power. And that was actually litigated and opposed. And I argued the motion in front of Judge McMahon. And Mike Eisenberg, if you recall, was the person that we had appointed for that work. Okay. And the other side opposed it vigorously, and the judge ordered it. And there was an example of corporate governance in the very early stages in the litigated context, not in the consent context, where we imposed something that was very important in terms of the filing process and the...
Actually, the Techniculture case was litigated as well, and that guy ended up in jail.
But there's a quote from Management Dynamics, which was a Second Circuit case litigated, which I think makes Irv's point, if I could read it, where Judge Kaufman, I believe, said, the SEC appears not as an ordinary litigant, but as a statutory guardian charged with safeguarding the public interest and enforcing the security laws, and therefore they would treat the request for ancillary relief differently than the private litigant. Right. And I think that summed up really the attitude in this 1975 of the Second Circuit and makes the point as to how we're able to get the relief that someone else might not get.
Yeah. One of the things that the Commission has recently done, which I think it's one of the greatest acts of enforcement that I can recall, was the recertification. I mean, that was brilliant. It diffused this whole situation. It made current. It brought everything current, and it was done through use of the provision 21A. Now, to go back to the old days, we used to use that 21A provision in many different ways. Ted, do you want to start out with?
Well, 21A was used actually on the governance side as a way of identifying conduct that we found in cases where the commission wanted to speak to a general practice but not bring an enforcement matter. Sterling Holmex, I believe, was the first case, which was a case that we brought, which we sued the company, we sued the underwriters, we sued the accountants, and we used 21A to address the conduct of the directors who should have known about the fraudulent financials in connection with the offering. But it then went on in a number of cases, Gould, National Student Marketing, there were a whole series of 21A reports, culminating, I believe, with a 21A report written by then-Commissioner Loomis, if I'm not mistaken, where there was actually some discussion, if someone can correct me, where Phil Loomis, as commissioner, discussed the use of 21A because there was some opposition at the commission, and he actually wrote as part of it, I dreamt this, but I think there was some contention, maybe around Roberta Carmel, it may have been around the time period where there was some question about it, but the commission used it to go to Irv's point, essentially. Here's practices we found which are not appropriate, and this is a way of improving conduct. And the commission used it. And I guess more recently in the Solomon Brothers scandal, it was used once again in terms of discussing the responsibility of the courses.
The legal issue was that Commissioner Carmel raised was, can you, is it fair to have a 21A report that's non-consensual? And the point there was that she thought that the party who was going to get a blast of bad publicity ought to have the right to make a response. Now, or have a right to say why it should be issued. But we used, as I recall, we were pretty creative. We used 21A quite a bit, did we not?
Yes.
And Herb, you used it in the market structure, did you not, in the hearings?
Yeah.
The 21A was an outlet that was very important to the program. You remember, the New York City report was a 21A report.
Right.
And we brought that because there were, as you recall, there were serious political overtones at the time that affected the investigation. We were conducting an investigation into the sale of municipal securities by New York City. And there were a lot of practices that had gone on that we came up with during the investigation that were serious and had to be treated. But there was also a concern that if we brought an enforcement action, it would appear to be directed at the Democratic administration in the city of New York, who was then in power. So the 21A report was utilized at that point just to put out a report without a lot of editorial comment about who did right and who did wrong, and just lay it out there with all the problems as a mechanism, again, to try to advance reform through legislation. It was all part of this whole municipal bond effort that we had taken. And I thought it was important because I don't know that we would ever have gotten an enforcement case through with respect to the actions of the various politicians and so forth at the time, whereas 21A report gave us a vehicle to get out there and discuss these issues in great detail and to alert the public to the issues and bring about a cure.
I think, Stan, what Wally's talking about, and I don't remember a National Student Marketing Report, Ted, as such, but I remember with Pete Marwick we did a report, which was essentially a 2E proceeding, where we got out the practices and tried to reform things by using the speaking vehicle. 21A was used for that. I don't remember, though, Stanley. I mean, I think we have to give the current commission credit for using 21A, in which they did, in a way which, frankly, at least to my memory, I don't think has ever been done before.
Oh, I think it's terrific.
And that is to require affirmatively the CEOs and CFOs to certify to something that I don't think had ever been done before.
No, but I think that 21A is one of the most incredible provisions that any agency can have. I think there's still other avenues that you can use 21A.
But I don't think it had been used.
And I'm not going to tell it now because I want to use it for some of my clients. But that's all right.
Well,
I will surprise them. But the point was that 21A has so many ramifications. And again, to the great credit of the sure, they can compel someone to make a statement. And before the certification concept, if you recall, the commission went to, was it WorldCom, and said, we want a report in 24 hours of what happened. The 21 says you can do it. It gives the commission powers to investigate. It gives commission powers to require statements. It gives commission powers to publish information. Terrific. But one of the things that what I think that reflects back to our time and to the present commission is the fact of scrubbing through those provisions to utilize every crumb that you can utilize. And we had to use them because we didn't have all the nice toys. But let me give you another area, and Irv, you probably remember this as well as anybody, the concept of public versus private proceedings. Now, no enforcer in his or her right mind would recommend a private proceeding, but we did, and we did it in a way that advanced the program. Do you remember that in the back office cases?
Yes, what will happen there was that industry lost control of its records, and it was a national disaster. And the remedy that we wanted was to get them back in control of their records.
What year was that?
And so, for example, in the 16. One case, the Lehman case, right, as I recall, Stanley called them in and said, you better go out there and hire 50 accountants and get your books and records in shape, otherwise we're going to suspend you.
If it was failed, they couldn't reconcile, so they failed to receive and failed to deliver because of the volume and a number of firms out of sync. And that
it was endemic, circular thing because it affected every firm in the industry.
Well, and everyone was running around the street at the end of the day delivering stock certificates. And the volume I checked just before I came down, in 1970, and these I think were in the late 60s.
Yeah.
But the average daily volume on the New York Stock Exchange in 1970 was about 10, 11 million shares a day. So it's...
Well, the reason they lost control in those days, they didn't have a centralized clearing settlement system. Everybody settled with every other broker-dealer he dealt with in the street. The only one that had a program was a centralized one, was the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. Right. And so there we used the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange system and induced the other exchanges within the time periods that we could do to get control over their own settlement periods, and that was the ultimate solution. But we had to solve the problem in the interim. And in the interim, we used the process that I just described. You know, if you look back in the history of the commission from its start, in the registration process, the statute only provided for a stop order procedure. But the people there were ingenious enough. They instituted what was called the letter of comment. It exists today, in which they would send a comment to the filer and say, here's what we think is wrong in your filing, and give you an opportunity to correct it. And I think that kind of approach, imagination using whether it's 21A or it's 15C211 or 10B5 or something else, was what made the commission's programs so effective over the years.
Yeah. On the public versus private, what happened was when we brought, we had to actually rack our brains. I recall this. Because we had to do something to the firm, but we couldn't disturb the whole industry. I mean, we were afraid of the public. There'd be a run on the bank, and that would have been a catastrophic. And so, in those days, very few cases were brought against New York Stock Exchange member firms. And so what we did is we looked at we used to literally look at the law, and it occurred to me, it says that the proceedings, I think it says, may be public, which indicates it may be private. And the theory was, the strategy was that we said, what we'll do is we need something to shake Lehman Brothers up, and so we'll institute a proceeding. But what we'll do is we'll make it a private proceeding so the public won't know right away what's going on. Hopefully, we can force them by use of the proceeding to come in and settle it, and that way they would go out and hire 150 accountants, I think it was, because they didn't have people. Bring it into compliance, and then what we would do is then we would announce the proceeding and announce the sanction, which was a nothing sanction because they had done everything. And so we used that. We must have used that in at least 10 to 15 cases against major brokerage firms. But that's what you have to do in with these statutes. The statutes, that was one of the reasons in the Sarbanes-Oxley bill. There are so many provisions in that law that can be used. Now, yeah, it's good to have, obviously, it's important that the Congress, gave a message. But you look at 13A under the 34 Act, and the Commission has full authority over accountants, over what statement, what the financial statements should contain. They forget about GAAP. They don't have to rely on GAAP. They can set up their own system. It's there in the law. It's never been used. Now, I'm not being critical that the commission hasn't used it, but what I'm saying is it's never been used to deal with this thing. There are a lot of other provisions in the law. For example, we used to use, and you fellows can join on this one, suspensions of trading as an effective tool until we got hit a little bit on that one.
I thought you were going to private proceedings in Sarbanes-Oxley because all the proceedings that this new accounting board is going to have to bring.
Yeah, but that was not. That
really,
was, Stanley, that was not our.
We used to bring successive suspensions for maybe a year
call
or two.
Call them rollovers. Oh, but Stanley, I think there's a really important point, what you and Irv were just saying about the paperwork crisis cases, and that is that we try to fix the problem.
Right.
And it would have been so easy, because there were this host of firms on the street who were just flat out of compliance. Their books and records were out of whack, their net capital and a lot of other things. They couldn't account for things. They were just out of ratio. The easiest thing would have been for us to rush in and enjoin or sue a half a dozen New York Stock Exchange member firms. But that wouldn't have fixed the problem. And virtually all the enforcement actions that were brought, the overriding objective is not just to sue the person and so on. It is whatever you do long term, you're trying to fix the problem. And that's what was done there.
And David now runs the program for the New York Stock Exchange, so I'm sure he's using many of these strategies. But go back to suspension of trading. Stop order proceedings. I noticed that the commission now is using stop order proceedings, which they hadn't used in before. Now, why would you use a stop order proceeding when you can go get an injunction? It depends upon the facts and circumstances. It may well be that a stop order might be more appropriate than going into a court. Suspension of trading, up until recently, the commission hadn't used that too much. You think it's too little used, or you think it's used just right, Ted? What do you think on suspensions?
I think the commission's using it now
more than they did before.
More than they did, and they're using it as an appropriate way of stopping where they hit. The internet and some of these other scams has created a lot of securities that are floating out there are worthless, and I think the 10-day suspension is a good way of quickly protecting the public where you have that going on, and I think it can be used that way, and also as a good notice provision.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the way we ended up using it. All right, we got a few minutes left. Let us go and ask these questions, and everybody just join in. What can the commission get today from the way enforcement was carried on in your days? Is there anything?
Stanley, you skipped the most important part, which is really a dedication to Irv.
What's that?
Which is the ethical, and you, frankly, the ethical lessons that come out of an enforcement program, and you can't do that with this fellow sitting next to
you. No, the only reason I skipped that was because we discussed it in the last hour about the ethical, the problems we
have. I think
Irv gave a speech. Do you want to give another one? On ethical problems?
Well, I think it's important not only for the commission. It's important for the
industry. But the more important point is that the two of you were at
when it is attempting to impose on its regulatory people a high standard of conduct, it has to be above that in its own performance.
Yeah, but I think you're overlooking the contribution, Irv, that you made when you were appointed to the commission in the face of a scandal in order to restore the integrity of the commission to the staff, so that the staff would believe in the integrity of the process. After Brad Cook had to resign as chairman, I just say that not as something. I think it's important to understand the process because we've been through those periods. Stanley himself was involved in a situation where he was basically told by the White House to kill a case and act appropriately.
Also, I wasn't told, but they told it through an intermediary. Is that Vesco?
Yeah.
But go ahead. We lived through these. We all lived.
Isn't that part of the history?
Well, you lived through one. What was this? Volotion was your scandal? What was that you lived through?
Hill Speaker's case.
Was that your case, the Volotion?
Something with it.
Stanley, can I come back to one of the things that you identified early, which I think is relevant both today and was relevant when we did is the fairness of an enforcement program.
So you think that that's what the staff can learn today? I think that's a good point you're making.
I think it is.
That's Herb's hallmark. Yeah.
And it is, and actually, I was one of the things in preparing for this, looking back, one of the things that I undertook in my efforts, I found was the Red Book, the Guide to Taking Testimony. As you recall, in the late 60s, there was no structure within the division of what the rights are, and we created, in fairness to the respondents, a whole, what was called the Red Book, I think it may still be the Red Book, I don't know today, where we put out a whole guide to our staff on how to comport itself relative to conducting an investigation. And I think this notion of being fair, given the power we had, was one of the hallmarks of what I think Irv and Stanley promoted. And I think a lesson could be learned today, or it should continue.
In other words, here, this is the time that really the staff and the commission has to use restraint more than ever before because they've been given all this new power and there's nothing that's going to stop them. They got powers now that in this culture it's going to go through it, and the staff does have to and the commission does have to use restraint.
I'd like to add one thing to that, and I think it's something that permeated the years that I was in enforcement, and that is the use of a very uncommon attribute called common sense. And I have found that many, many times a zealous attitude overwhelms common sense. And I think that one of the greatest things that the Enforcement Division at least demonstrated to me was the use of common sense. I had been in the private practice law for 20 years before I came here, as you may recall. And I found that, by and large, for the most part, common sense was exercised in great abundance. And I think that one of the greatest legacies that any of us who were there can have passed on is that the use of common sense in investigations and in treatment of people, conducting the investigations, and fitting right in with Ted's views and on the so-called Red Book.
Yeah, but actually, you know, the interesting thing was
we drew distinctions in the Enforcement Division when we were recommending cases to the commission. We were not on autopilot. In other words, we did not say that every person who had a brush with the problem had to be dumped into a case. We tried to bring cases that made a lot of sense because the people who were truly involved were included in the cases. And we tried to bring common sense, as Ben said, to the range of charges that we brought. And that was important because we had to have credibility. We had to have credibility with the commission. We had to have credibility with the bar when we brought these cases. So there was definitely an effort to approach a case in a way, something other than automatically trying to bring every single charge that you could bring or every single person that you could bring. And that was highlighted especially in the foreign payments in the question.
I would extend that a little bit. I think that the staff has to feel that they can be aggressive. There's a lot of work to do, and they will be supported if they're aggressive, but you have to balance it with fairness.
In other words,
it's much easier, frankly, to be aggressive than it is to be fair. It takes a certain amount of experience and security in yourself or your managers to make a decision not to sue someone just because it doesn't need to be done. It's easier. It's easier and safer to be aggressive. So I think it's part of there's a balance, and part of it is a lot is I think experience.
I remember, Stanley, exactly what Dave's talking about. I remember a case that was not a case. You had brought a case against a number of the institutions and senior people, and then there was a young kid who had gone to the finest schools who had basically learned to launder money. And instead of suing this kid, you brought him into your office, and you had a face-to-face conversation with him, but basically you told him we were going to give him a pass, and you told him all of the blessings he had gotten and brought a non-case. And to me, that was one of the final...
No, I think the day I arrived as a lawyer, I felt good about it, or it was the time that I had recommended the suit of a lawyer who was a compliance director in a firm, and that when I looked at the facts, I learned that he had told his boss not to do something. And we had an aggressive staff that insisted that we name him because he didn't do enough. He had to quit. And I thought that was asking too much, the requirement to quit a job. So after the commission had authorized the action and we had gone about to bring it, I told Herb I was going to go back to the commission and say that my conscience would not permit me to sue this person. Herb said, go ahead. And we drop that person from the lawsuit. That's when you know that you've arrived, when you can do something and that thing. But let me say this, and I guess we got about a second left. What I am so ecstatic about in this day and age is that, first of all, there is tremendous support out there for the commission and the enforcement program. The Enforcement Division has good people. I'm being self-serving because my son's there, but I'm talking about right up to the top, and Cutlers and the Thompsons and all the rest of the people all the way down. Now, but even more important, not more important, but as important, is you've got a fantastic commission now, and I am so proud to see this commission with the intellect that's there now. It is absolutely incredible, and there ought to be some really great things happening. I think you saw what happened with the certification, how, you know, nobody gives the chairman of the commission any credit for what they do, but look how that diffused this terrible situation out there. You don't hear people talking anymore about, you know, companies folding or whatnot. I mean, before that day in August, everybody thought the whole financial community was collapsing. And that thing really calmed things. It was a brilliant act, and you're going to see a lot more brilliant, I think, from this commission. But I do think what our panel said, Irv, that fairness is still a very important thing. What do you think?
When somebody used to come and ask whether something was legal to do, we used to say that's not the question you ask. The question is, as long as it's legal to do it, is it fair to do it? That's the standard that you work to apply. And I think that is why the enforcement division can be as aggressive and imaginative in its program and yet accomplish a respect among the people who recognize that there can to improve their operations and to make it easier for them to make a good buck in their business and at the same time serve their customers and society well.
Listen, I thank you people that have stayed with us. You're terrific to have been here. And I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed as much as I've enjoyed it. Oh, the panels are I told them they're going to see the A material here.
Thank you very much.
Good guys.
Good job.
Yeah.
Stanley.
Very nice.
Well done.
I think it was good.
All this history.